from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Bob Menkoff has been a regular cartoonist for The New Yorker for decades, and he is now the magazine's cartoon editor. He joins us to discuss cartooning, ways to win The New Yorker Cartoon Captions Contest, and his most recent book, How About Never? Is Never Good for You? That's up in the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. In his new memoir, Bob Menkoff recalls being an indifferent student who frequently cut class during college. Once when he showed up in sociology class for the final exam, his professor asked, "Who the hell are you?" Menkoff replied, "You know, I could very well ask you the same question." Despite his slacking, Menkoff's sense of humor served him well. He became a successful cartoonist, fulfilled his dream of getting published in The New Yorker, and eventually became the cartoon editor at that magazine. Bob Menkoff joins us in studio this hour to discuss his new memoir, How About Never? Is Never Good for You? My Life in Cartoons. Welcome and happy birthday. It just so happens I managed to discover through my incisive interviewing here that today is Bob Menkoff's birthday, and it's a big one, a milestone, so congratulations.
Absolutely. You know, 70 years and 10, and we were joking before, and you know, that people say 70 is the new 50, but dead isn't the new alive. And I got a lot of happy birthday stuff, and I always like to be, you know, humor is my thing in the email, so you know, I had a little line this morning. I emailed someone and I said, well, the good news is it could be worse. The bad news is it will be.
That's a chestnut to keep. Yeah. You know, I was thinking, though, looking over your career, you began, as so many began, by submitting over 502 years. And then you were accepted and, you know, moved up the ladder, so to speak, in the food chain there. Now you're the editor of cartoons. You get thousands of submissions. How empathic are you, having gone through all that rejection? I mean, you write nice letters and you take personal...
It's tough love. That's what you need, because in the end, I do care. I understand how difficult it is be rejected. On the other hand, it's a lot easier rejecting than being rejected, as we all know. So it's much easier to tolerate other people's pain than your own. But I do have a lot of the cartoonists are my friends. But what gets in the magazine has to get in the magazine based on its own, on its own merit. So professionals understand that. Amateurs don't. Amateurs, difference between professionals and amateurs is amateurs like what they do. They think it's really great.
You also have to get the supreme veto approval of David Remnick.
Absolutely. The
Supreme. So you can the supreme say, it's his fault that I didn't publish your
right,
cartoon.
Right, and that's generally true. The cartoons that you like in the magazine, I've helped select, and the ones you don't is David. That's a joke, David.
Title of your new book, How About Never Is Never Good For You, that's gone through a metamorphosis too. I mean, at first it was a business guy, and now it's the Grim Reaper.
Well, everyone's ripped off that line. I recently got a copyright to it, and you know, and the trademark and everything. It's all over. Everything is all over, and I'm not getting any money for it. It's for T-shirts and mugs, and also it's on thongs as well. And I think the offer to give me as many free thongs as I wanted for this, I didn't think that was right. So my people are talking to their people. Yeah, it has. It's a line that now is in, you know, the Yale Book of Quotations, right next to that other famous humorous Mao Zedong.
Well, we're going to ask people their favorite New Yorker cartoons over the course of this hour, and you can indeed let us know what those are.
Okay.
My favorite cartoon, I must say, and there are certain words I can't use on the radio from The New Yorker, and I noticed that in your book you talk about David Mamet sending you cartoons.
Right, right.
But there was a great cartoon of a guy very spiffily dressed in New York, obviously going to the theater, and a panhandler coming up to him and asking for money, and he says, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be." Shakespeare, and the guy says, blank you, David Mamet.
That's not a New Yorker criterion.
It isn't. I thought it was a New Yorker criterion.
No. We don't use that word in the New Yorker cartoons. We don't for the most part. For example, when The Sopranos was on, I showed a cartoon to David Remnick. Once again, you're not going to be able to say it. You can just bleep it out if I say it.
I'll use some other euphemism
because if people heard this word that starts anyway, who knows what would happen? Seismic plates could shift on a place like this. Okay, so anyway, it has a tough guy like a Tony Soprano guy saying in a boardroom type with his guys around him, if these walls could talk and they knew what was good for them, they'd shut the F up. Okay, but we didn't put that cartoon.
So I'm befuddled by the mystery where that. I always had it as a New Yorker.
Well, people's favorite New Yorker cartoon is sometimes not a New Yorker cartoon, and that's great because it's the imprimatur of the New Yorker. They assume if it's a great cartoon, it must be.
Why can't you use words like that? I mean,
my goodness, why can't you use words?
Well, we can't
like
use them on the radio, but in the magazine you can use them, right?
I see the radio is different because
FCC regulations.
I see. Well, so it's DR regulations, David Remnick regulations. Really, it's the tone. It's the tone of it. And the New Yorker cartoons are basically benign, sort of cerebral, sort of idea things. And, of course, in any one exception, you'd see that. But for the same reason the New York Times doesn't use the word, which is not because of regulations. It's really about a tone of the magazine. And I talk about this in the book about context, how things fit mm-hmm. into context within reading the New Yorker magazine, which is basically empathetic, and humor, which is all often based on antipathy. And so there's a fine line, because one of the things is the humor is a form of communication. As an audience, it needs to work. It's utilitarian. It's not in and of itself. So cartoons that would work in something like Cartoonist for New Yorker, Matt Diffie's The Rejection Collection, would not work very well in The New Yorker. I'll give you an example. Okay, this is after the Danish cartoon controversy, okay? And Sam Gross submitted a cartoon to us.
That was the name of our law professor in the last segment, by
okay.
the way.
Okay, not that Sam Gross. The funny Sam Gross. submitted where it's a suicide bomber in heaven. He's all blown to bits. And there's an imam, maybe he's even Muhammad, talking to him and saying, you get the virgins when we find your penis. Okay, so that cartoon, actually, now you didn't laugh at it, but if I show that in a presentation, if I show that in an isolated audience, if I show that where you're not also concerned about who it's going out to here, be raucous laughter. Context is everything. In the New Yorker, that wouldn't be funny. In something like the Rejection Collection, it is where you expect.
Why
it.
The rejection of Spiegelman's cartoon, though, with I Have a Dream? I mean, that was...
Well, I don't actually know whether... maybe that was the cover. I'm not involved with the cover. Françoise Mulet, the wonderful cover editor, is involved.
His wife.
His wife. Yeah. His wife. Who rejected him. So the argument that may have come out of that, I have no idea.
Well, let's talk about the effects of cartoons, too. I mean, I kept thinking about Oliphant and Herb Bloch and some of these great cartoonists who had immense political effect, even countercultural effect, yeah. like R. Crumb and so forth. New Yorker cartoons are much more sort of,
Say something good.
Well, elitist would be the word.
No, you're wrong. You're wrong. New Yorker cartoons are benign. They're directed back. Everybody thinks, editorial, we're going to speak truth to power. Has power ever picked up the phone? Okay, we're not speaking truth to power. In other words, we're doing that, and that's fine. That's what editorial cartoons are about. Our cartoons are directed back to the audience who is reading it. The problem with global warming is not what Exxon is doing. The problem is what you're doing. So for a cartoon like ours, you know, there might be a Mick Stevens cartoon with saying it's a car dealer saying. It runs on, you know, conventional engine, conventional gasoline until it senses guilt, and then it switches over to electricity. A cartoon by Alex Gregory, two cavemen. One is saying to the other, I don't understand it. The air is pure. The water is pure. everything we eat is organic. We only live to be 30.
I remember that cartoon.
Okay, so that my point is, though, this is where our humor is directed.
To the bourgeoisie.
No, right back to, exactly. That's where I think it's most telling. That's where it's most, actually, to me, most interesting. It's always, look, the other type of humor, editorial humor, is all dispositional. You know, it depends. Basically, if you're, and it can be good, but basically, your friends make fun of your enemies, you know, funny. The other way around, not so much.
We're talking again with Bob Mankoff. His new book is now, All About Never.
I want to say I have a chapter in here called, I'm not arguing, I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
Now, but clearly, you see, it always said, this is how what happened, because my wife, who is a WASP, when we were courting, that's why I have the chapter, she said, why are you arguing with me? I said, I'm not arguing, I'm Jewish. So I'm not arguing here, I am Jewish.
And your humor really stems from your mother. A lot of your first chapter has to do with your origins and memoir writing and so forth. Why do you think, I mean, it's maybe a silly question in some ways, but everybody has answers for why there are so many Jewish stand-up comics or why there are so many Jews in comedy.
But I have the right answer.
But, well, you were influenced by Jerry Lewis. Maybe there's something that in that about you being perhaps tied to France. But what I've been struck by with Michael Chabon's novel, with Shel Silverstein, I know who you were an admirer of, Sal Steiner, The New Yorker, so many Jews who are cartoonists, specifically cartoonists, Art Spiegelman.
And humor in general, probably less represented in cartooning than in comedy in general, which is pointed out in like 1979, 80% of the people involved. I think there are many answers to it. One of them, probably the foremost, is Eastern Europe in the late 19th centuries, when the Jews are freed from a lot of persecution, yet they're still being persecuted. They are so they're the other in another culture, yet they are in conflict with themselves between the people who are assimilating, the Hasidic Jews, the Orthodox Jews. One of the weapons they have is, of course, humor, both against the outside, what they call the goyim, and the inside. So this is a cauldron. This is a recipe for humor. There's both conflict and powerlessness within this situation. On top of that, you have Yiddish. So Yiddish, you have this mashup language itself, which takes from the other culture. You have the feelings the Jews have because of their intelligence and education of both being superior to the culture without it. At the same time, the culture is telling them they're inferior, they're persecuting them. You have the conflict, which is tried to resolve with humor, of being the chosen people when they're asking, could you choose someone else? So I think you have this amazing confluence of events that, besides the fact of all the logic trapping that comes from the Talmud and all that, all of this coming together in making unique Jewish humor, which depends very much not on transgression, but on logic trapping, on conflict. You know, the great Jewish jokes where there's the matchmaker who would bring the wife and the potential wife and the groom together, and the groom says, why did you bring me this woman? She's hunchbacked. She's blind. She's got a limp. And the matchmaker says, you don't have to whisper, she's deaf too. So anyway, that's it. So that's
actually
your answer.
The perfect metaphor for Jewish humor has always been the golem to me. You know, you use it defensively, you use it offensively.
Right. So that's one of the interesting things about it. Offensively, defensively, self-deprecatingly, you know, the great Jewish joke is Moshe and Heshi, and they go by a church, and the church says $20 or $100, whatever, for conversions. And Heshi says, you know what, I'm going to go in, I'm going to check it out. He stays a long, long time. He comes out, and so his friend asks him, so did you get the money? He says, you people, all you think about is money.
I'm not going to turn this into a Jewish joke fest, though.
Yeah,
part of me would like to. Bob Mankoff in the studio with us, writing about my life in cartoons. How About Never is never good for you. And you mentioned your favorite cartoonist, Jack Ziegler.
Well, Jack Ziegler is just such an amazing, I mean, I have many favorites, but Jack Ziegler is, such an amazing cartoonist. If you look at all of his cartoons, his drawing is always different. The range of his humor is completely different. He can deal with the most delicate topics and still make them humorous. There's a great cartoon he has where it's a gallows It's got the steps going up to the gallows, but there's also a ramp for the handicapped.
You're going to Google after you appear here on this program. And in 1992, you founded an online cartoon bank, which is really quite well known now, to put it mildly. But there's always been a kind of ambivalence with you in technology, I think. And many of these cartoons highlight that. There's one where these two dogs are working at different computers, and they say, well, nobody can tell we're dogs, you know.
It's on the Internet. No one knows you're a dog.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that reflective maybe of some kind of ambivalence?
Well, no. I mean, that cartoon's from 1992. I certainly have ambivalence. I have a blog up today, I think, in the article called King of All Gadgets, which shows all the gadgets I bought over my lifetime and shows them all the dead gadgets. And recently I bought a GoPro head thing. And so I have a love-hate affair, you know, with technology. I mean, recently I looked at my Gmail and I say, it actually said, you have 27,602 unread mails. And I realized, you know what? I'm 70. I'm never going to get to those.
What do you think about the way cartoons have – I mean, I remember as a kid, you do too, I'm sure, reading classic comics. Now we talk about graphic novels. They're really cartoons though, aren't they?
I mean – Well, it's something is really – you can always have a broader category. Graphic novels are, I think, a different form. I mean, comics – obviously, they derive from comics, but one of the things is they are not necessarily comic at all. I mean, you know, we talked about Art Spiegelman. You know, Mouse is a classic of that type. So there are things that you can do in drawing and writing that you can't do, you know, separately. But essentially, that's not my bailiwick, really. I'm not a graphic novelist, and for the most part, we don't publish that. But it's a whole other form. And as a kid, I was a great fan of comic books themselves.
As a kid, you were drawing pretty early. I mean, drawing the matchbook stuff and all that.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, you know, you can't really say why it happens or when it happens, but I was, you know, drawing 7 and 8, and I have in the book sort of versions of little cartoons that I drew. So I think the die was cast, but it took a little while to get stamped.
Who is editor, whether it's William Shawn, Tina Brown, or David Remnick, means a lot in terms of stamping what kind of cartoons go in the New Yorker, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the editor has the overall, you know, bird's eye perspective of everything in the magazine. When it's William Shawn, that was a much different perspective. It was much more, I think, of an isolated ivory tower perspective. The New Yorker was a castle, a thing unto itself. The covers never referred to anything that was in the outside world. Now, of course, very much they do. Topics, sexual topics, were pretty much out of bounds, even if they were very, very mild. With Tina, that changed. And Tina was all about really what was happening, buzz. And I think that was all to the good, really. Certainly all to the good for me. Tina was the one who selected How About Never Is Never Good For You. So I wouldn't be here, certainly, if not for Tina. And but David, to me, frankly, is the ideal editor and really partner in cartoons, because he has a wonderful sense of the world itself, being a reporter. What's not just hot, what's buzzy, but what's significant. And also, he has a wonderful sense of humor.
He's more than a reporter. I mean, he did a damn good book on Muhammad Ali. He did a very good book on
That's right,
Russia.
David. You're much more than a reporter. I take that back. I retract that. And you're quite tall and good-looking, too.
Whatever happened to Alice Guerin, do you know?
Whatever happened? Whatever happened, that this is a girl I had the hots for, and
you make it very clear
in my book, my suppressed libidinal energy went into cartoons and basketball, and you know what, Alice, it's too late now.
Actually also psychology. You studied psychology. It made a big difference in your whole worldview, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, psychology.
This was at Syracuse.
Syracuse, the only. And then in grad school at City University in New York. And I've come back to that recently. And in terms of the psychology of humor, analyzing humor, doing research on humor. You know, E.B. White said analyzing humor is like dissecting a frog. Nobody's much interested in the frog dies. I think everybody's pretty much interested now. It's such this pervasive force in our society. It's so important to ignore it would be, to me, just crazy. So I'll kill a few frogs and for a good cause.
Well, let's go back to your book. I mean, this book in some ways is built around your life in cartooning.
I mean,
to a great extent, the cartoons even dovetail a lot with the narratives.
Well, the cartoons completely dovetail with the narrative in that that's the way I wanted to. That's the way I sort of learned to write or felt that I could write. I started writing a blog for The New Yorker, and it was just very natural for me to whatever I was writing to insert a relevant cartoon and then to riff or to expatiate on that cartoon. And I do think, in fact, that more and more writing will be like this writing where images are completely integrated into the text as the technology permits it. For me, it's very easy. I have a database of all 80,000 cartoons. As I'm writing in Word, I can just plop them in. But I do see a time, and this is where technology interests me, where right now as you're writing something, you can select a synonym. You can have a grammar tracker. Maybe you'll have a humor tracker. I doubt that. But you'd certainly be able to access images.
David Remnick is your humor checker.
Yeah, right.
But that's a good part of the new technology.
Wonderful part. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful part. It's narration now can combine. That's already happened for a very long time, obviously, with television. When you're watching television, basically you're hearing text and images are over that. Now, it seems to me, and you'll see more and more, I think, with newspapers and as print media moves digitally, you see it with the New York Times, I'm sure, the LA Times, that you'll go onto the site and you'll be reading and then there'll be a video inserted, there'll be photos mm-hmm. inserted. It just really, I mean, it makes sense to me.
That's the way of all flesh now, as far as
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, the way. I know people will bemoan it, but, you know, Plato and Aristotle bemoan books themselves because now you couldn't use your memory and people think that, oh, it's, you know, the internet. And now you have to look now you can just look everything up. I think basically the arc of all this progress is progress.
I'm looking at a tweet here from a listener who asks if you'll pay tribute to Al Feldstein. I guess this is a former longtime editor of Mad Magazine who just died on Tuesday.
Oh, well, a toast and a tribute. I mean, probably not within the magazine itself, but, you know, maybe in a blog or something like this. I mean, it's hard to pay tribute to everybody who's dying, you know. You didn't have any other room for anything.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with the New Yorker cartoon editor and cartoonist, and there are many cartoons in addition to his and his book, How About Never is Never Good for You. If you'd like to join us, if you have some thoughts about the New Yorker, its cartoons, I'd particularly like to hear from listeners who have a favorite cartoon and one that actually appeared in the New Yorker, unlike my Mammoth cartoon. You can join us and, in fact, are invited to do so now. If you'd like to talk to Bob Menkoff, we welcome your phone calls. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And also, you're talking about funny checkers and all. This book has a lot to do, his memoir, with what's funny and how we judge what's funny.
Yeah.
He gets back to his mother in this. That's very Oedipal, and we won't even go there in terms of his psychological studies. But throw the question out to listeners and everything, particularly in cartoons. What makes you laugh? And do you have a favorite cartoon? And should cartoons be political? A lot of questions kind of hovering around in this discussion, and we do welcome your participation. Feel free to join the conversation. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, especially if you have comments or questions or a favorite cartoon you want to bring to the fore. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and reach us online, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle, again, is @KQEDForum. And we'll continue with Bob Menkoff. It's too bad I don't have a couch in here. I could put you on. We could talk about your mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Menkoff. It's his birthday, and also he's the author of a new book, How About Never is Never Good for You. He's also the author of a number of other things like The Naked Cartoonist, and that's subtitled A Way to Enhance Your Creativity, and edited 14 collections of New Yorker cartoons. And we'll be at Google later, and are you going to stick around San Francisco a while?
I'm actually got a friend at Google. I'm going to be going up north somewhere to some ranch he has, and avoiding getting on any horses.
All right. Also, Judy Campbell just said, if any of you who are listening would like New Yorker cartoons explained to you, which I thought was an excellent suggestion, please feel free to avail yourself of our ways of communicating, which again, toll-free number 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And Sandy writes, my in-law's refrigerator was held together by New Yorker cartoons for years. That will be of interest, I think, and so will some of our callers. Let's begin, Mark, with you. Mark, you're on.
Well, hi. This is Mark from San Jose, and Michael, thank you again for another wonderful show. I'm calling out of really self-pity, to be honest. My husband's father lives in New York, and he and his father both speak fluent Yiddish. I don't. I'm about as goy as you could be. And every time I visit him in New York, I want to tell an original joke, and I usually fall flat in my face. And I get this look, and I just wondered if, you know, this is a cultural or perhaps a genetic thing, I should just give up.
Not genetic, absolutely.
But I will give you, just out of my great beneficence, a great joke to tell your in-laws, because it's easy, it's quick. Unfortunately, it's been spread all over the Internet, and it ruins the telling of it, but you can tell it very easily. And that is the seven words that really have to do with every single Jewish celebration and Jewish holiday and Jewish religious holiday particularly, and that is, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat.
Yeah.
That'll work. What do you think, Bob?
Right. Yeah,
or
even better yet, Mark, buy my book and take it there and show them the cartoons. So, you know, that way, if it doesn't work, it's on, if it doesn't work, it's on me. but interestingly, you know, talking about the psychology of humor and stuff, genetically, people are not born funny or unfunny. What they are born is sort of jolly or sort of dour. So they're people who laugh a lot. But one of the things when they do experiments where, you know, they don't do experiments, but identical twins, you know, separated at birth and stuff like that. If they're the people who laugh a lot, the jollity, you do find, you know, the environment doesn't matter. But the environment matters very, very much, in humor. But I would suggest really the thing is to be funny is just to look at, not tell jokes really. I don't really think. It's just to look at the absolute absurd side of life. You know, so, I mean, how long, so if you're on the airplane now and they're telling you this is a non-smoking flight, okay, where are the smoking flights? Or when they tell you that, they tell you as though it's a good thing that your seat cushion can be used as a flotation device, that is the most horrible thing I can imagine.
Well, your mother taught you well, though. I mean, she said humor thrives on conflict and needs a target.
That's right. Needs a target. And my mother was my first target because, you know, she insulted me. She insulted me with love in Yiddish, calling me Groyser Pferd, big horse, Kleiner Hint, little dog. And the best of all, which was Nervus Cholera, which is cholera's
it's cholera.
It was plague. I was a nervous plague.
Here's Chris. Chris, you're on. Hi.
Hi, I just love your work, and I have a really nice rejection letter from a New Yorker for a cartoon. And but I wonder maybe you could explain if people can submit cartoons. And I had a couple of ideas for a cartoon, if I could tell you, that maybe somebody would want to do.
Absolutely, but let me just say this, that everybody has an idea for a cartoon, at least almost everybody I ever come across. When I was at my cardiologist, he put me at my ease. He asked me what I did for a living. And I told him I'm a cartoon editor, shut off all the machines, quickly told me he had an idea for a cartoon. I said, great, I got an idea for a bypass. So what's your idea?
Well, one of them would be two kids laying down, looking up at the sky, or two boys.
Particularly right, but the New York.
I wouldn't pass muster.
Yeah, okay. But next?
The other one is two gurus sitting on the mountaintop and one saying to the other, I miss idle chatter.
Well, that's sort of New York.
That's more New Yorker,
It's a little mine. Keep your day job.
I know. I'm keeping my day job. But really
that's great. But you know what? Those are okay in this sense. And, you know, we have a caption contest where thousands of people can enter. I admire anybody who tries to make any joke at any time. It's the people, you know, most jokes aren't great. And the only good ones that you get is by doing a lot of bad ones. So jokes are like ideas in general. So, you know, keep it up.
You might good luck to you, Chris. Yeah. And thank you for calling here. If you see one of those appear in the New Yorker, you can bring
litigation.
Yeah,
and stop looking up at the sky, at the cloud, okay?
Well, now you mentioned the caption contest. I don't know about you, but in terms of true advertising, a lot of your publisher notes have said you can find out how to win the caption contest if you read Bob's book.
Yeah,
it's a little bit of false advertising there. I mean, you have to have some cleverness.
But compared
to
all the real false advertising that exists in the world, that is so truthy, as Stephen Colbert could say. I mean, on the radio, I heard an advertisement that told me I could turn my crushing debt into instant wealth. You know, I mean, at the same time, eat all the foods I want and not gain any weight. So basically, I give you some good tips on how to write better captions. And I put win in quotes because it's hard. There are 5,000 to 10,000 people entering. So it's a difficult thing. But we look at every single caption, every single caption. We look at everything anonymously. You know, if it's from Michael Bloomberg, if it's from Maureen Dowd, if it's from Zach Galifianakis, all people who submitted, you know, we only look afterwards. You know what I mean? So far, I don't think the Pope has submitted anything, but everything will be evaluated fairly.
No, you got a new pope. Dorothy writes, several years ago, I picked up a book entitled Trauma Stewardship by Laura Van Dernoot Lipsky with Connie Burke. It's a powerful book about secondary trauma. The message is lightened by New Yorker cartoons sprinkled liberally throughout. My favorite, a man floundering in the water calls out, Lassie, get help. And the next frame, we see Lassie on a psychiatrist's couch.
That's Danny Shanahan's, your classic cartoon, I think also from the early 90s. And it's an interesting point because one of the things humor does besides entertainment is it's a coping mechanism. Humor, laughter itself is an emotional regulation mechanism. Humor is about everything that's bad. There are no cartoons and no jokes about good marriages, good vacations, good children, good pets, good anything, and certainly not good government.
But you know, Freud wrote a book about humor, and he said that it's a way to release anxiety, but also aggression, and it also reveals and becomes almost a way of seeing what's in the unconscious. It brings out repression.
It can. I mean, it's a fairly, you know, there are a lot of books since the 1905 book, and to some extent, of course, it was based on psychoanalytic theory. It's right, but it's basically wrong.
Here's Jessica who writes, like most psychoanalytic theory, my father, Jewish for what it's worth, strange parenthetical.
Worth a lot. Worth a lot.
Always kept a file marked humor. Now I have one, too, as well as a big notebook of cartoons I've snipped over the years, including lots from The New Yorker. Some of my favorites are by B.E.K. Beck. The very first cartoon in my book is his. It's a man and a woman walking into their apartment, number 2B. The man is carrying a briefcase and the woman is carrying a baby who is facing out and frowning furiously. The baby's thought bubble says, oh, great, humble beginnings.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, that's Bruce Eric Kaplan, who also was a writer for Seinfeld, wrote the Seinfeld episode where Elaine doesn't get the cartoon, is also executive producer on Girls and 6 Feet Under. So he's quite an amazing guy and a wonderful cartoonist. And Bruce, if you're out there and hear this, get back to cartooning.
And we'll get back to more of your calls. Jay, you're on Forum. Morning.
Hi, guys. Great. Sports humor is hard to do, and you guys do it great. My all-time favorite is a baseball cartoon. It's a conference at the pitcher's mound. The pitcher's in trouble. And
Wait a second. Let me see if I can guess what it is. It says strike him out?
No. conference at the mound, manager, pitcher, the infield. But also up there is the batter, and the batter says, hey, you guys want to know what I think?
Yeah. There's wonderful wonderful sports cartoons. Also, mocking really, you know, sports itself. I'm trying to remember, there's a cartoon where a guy Yankee is texting, you know, and he's texting. Yeah, I'm up at bat right now. Oh, I just struck out.
Well, you know, The New Yorker has some of the best sports writing. I mean, think about the two Rogers, Kahn and Roger Angel.
Right.
And we're talking, by the way, with Bob Menkoff, who has, by his own admission, the best job in the world. It's his birthday, and his book is How About Never is Never Good for You. And we're going to go to some more of your calls here. Let's get as many of you on as we can, and we'll go up to Napa. Robin, Hi.
Hi, good morning, happy birthday. And
thank you.
Really, the How About Never is probably my favorite cartoon.
Thank you.
But I have two more.
Good.
One is the cat and the dog. I think it's the cat that says, they're in the apartment. The cat says to the dog, you could see that the owners are leaving for the evening. And the cat says, when they leave, I'm in charge.
Yeah.
That was. But my favorite, my second favorite after yours is the pasta on the telephone. You know the one I'm talking about?
Go ahead.
And he's talking into the phone and he says, Fusilli, you crazy bastard.
Oh, yeah. That's Charles. Oh, the pasta. I didn't hear that. Yeah, that's Charles Borsati cartoon. Fusilli, there's a pasta on the phone, big piece, rigatoni, I think. He said, Fusilli, you crazy bastard, how are you? Yeah, that is a wonderful classic by Charlie Borsati out there in Kansas City. Charlie, if you're listening, that cartoon of yours is great, and so many are.
And we thank you for the call, Robin. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. Your style, cartooning, yours was her favorite, and many of yours are the favorite of many people. It's been called stippling style, yeah?
Yeah, stippling, that means that
stippling
dots,
is
dots,
dot, 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 like a
poitilius. Yeah, in the book I say it sounds like a dermatological disease, you know.
And or Surratt.
Or Surratt, right. And it's this weird style I developed when I was at the High School of Music and Art. It was just my way of sketching. I would just take this little fine little pen and point and make funny faces and stuff, and it's very cumbersome. I don't recommend it to anybody else, but it's my style, and I'm stuck with it.
And Kathy wants to know, how did the cartoon caption contest come to be?
How did it come to be? Well, in the second cartoon issue, we don't have the cartoon issue, which wasn't devoted completely to cartoons. It's a big section on cartoons. Now we have a cartoon, a special edition publication that comes out here on newsstands, which is just cartoons. I suggested to David Remnick that we have a back page in which there was an incongruous image and that the people could write in. This was 1998 or so, and put a caption to it. And that was very successful but incredibly cumbersome because 13,000 people wrote in or something, and it was months we could go through it. In 2005, David was looking for something for the back page that he said was wanted to be like the New York Times crossword puzzle, that you wouldn't have to write about it. It could just happen and you could do it. And he wondered, could we do the caption contest? I said, well, that's impossible because how are we going to put it in and the very next week have the answers when the magazine closes on Friday? Well, we figured out a way where we stagger it, where between when the contest appears and to when you see the winner, it's 4 weeks, and that on every page, there's a contest that you enter, one in which you vote on, 3 votes, and the winner. So I guess originally the general idea was mine, and then the real idea which made it took off was David's, which is to make it every week.
And again, we're with Bob Mankoff. You can join us by email, forum at kqed.org, or call us at 866-733-6786 or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here are some web comments. Ben writes, I always loved the New Yorker cartoons. My favorite was the cover cartoon of a map of the United States where basically all of the U.S. is just New York with a sliver of California. My favorite cartoons are in Playboy, similar to the New Yorker but more crass. Heather writes, my favorite is the germ strapped into the airline seat. Who can't relate to this? Sublime yet universal.
If I was a caption contest.
And Nicole writes, I have loved the two covers in particular. Walter White, Bryan Cranston, discovering Assad in his lab. Multiple Putins judging a Putin in figure skating. Okay, we'll get more of your favorites. Keep them coming, and we'll go to Bill in Oakland next as a caller. Bill, hi.
Oh, hi. So I want to say everything I know about humor I learned from The New Yorker. When the, like in the 50s and 60s, when it would show up weekly, I'd try and read the cartoons, and of course I didn't understand any of them, and I'd take them into my father and I'd say, what's so funny about this one? What's so funny about this one? And then they ended up getting the book. I guess it was published in the 60s. And one of the first cartoons in that book was this big black pool. And I never understood it until I finally realized in my, I don't know, 50s or 60s that they were diving for a bar of ivory soap. A bar of ivory soap had sunk. Anyway, I'm up. I'm trying to remember a cartoon that I think I saw in the New Yorker, probably in the 60s, and it's a negative image of a professor at the blackboard, and all full of equations. And the professor says, "Well, so we have to conclude that somewhere in the universe, there's a location that's made up of matter.
Right, right. So that's the old switcheroo. Yeah, I think that was in the 60s. And one of the things that refers that shows is, for the most part, to understand a lot of New York cartoons, you have to understand something else.
You need a frame of reference. You need to be informed, really.
Yeah, you need to be informed, and you don't really have to know all that much about antimatter or what it is, but at least you have to know that probably it was in the news at some times. Probably there was some article somewhere talking about theories and antimatter that referred to. So I'm happy we really helped with your humor education, and I hope it continues.
And we thank you, Bill, for the call. And if any of you can remember where that mammoth cartoon I was searching for before that I thought was in New Yorker actually
I don't even think it's
appeared.
A cartoon. It's just a joke.
I saw it as a cartoon. No, I'm certain I saw it as a cartoon because the guy was dressed up to go to the theater and all that.
Yeah, these are the tricks memory plays when we get to be our age.
No, trust me. I mean, I'm in my senescence already, but right. But things like that are eidetic.
Okay.
Know? They remain. I'll tell you what else is eidetic in reading your book. There's a...
you know, now that this is a high-class show. You don't get eidetic, meaning like imagery that's in your mind that you remember, unless you're talking to somebody really smart.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
And I'm pretty smart because I even knew what it was. Okay.
I was actually talking just the other day about some interviews I did in the past with Norman Mailer, and there's this terrific story that you tell, and I'd like you to tell it, about Mailer submitting. So.
Yeah, Mailer, I get a call, and actually my assistant said, it's Norman Mailer, he wants to come in and show you a card. I think he's got the wrong department, really. I mean, because I didn't know that he does cartoons. Well, anyway, he came in, and he was quite elderly at the time, on crutches and everything. Nice guy. And he showed me things that later he published both the poems and the cartoons in a book called Modest Gifts, which was very aptly titled. So the cartoons were these little squiggles with faces, and then he would write something under it. And what I said to him is, I said, Norman, even if these were good, there would be no way we'd publish it, because all anyone would be thinking was, this is something, it would completely misdirect what I like, and I think David likes. Of course, we know who the cartoonist, we know who Roz Chast is, we know, but there's a certain anonymity about the cartoons also, of judgment, where you're not being overwhelmed by who the person is, by that personality, but the personality comes through the cartoon. So that's why we couldn't use Norman Mailer's cartoons. I think actually maybe they were eventually published in Vanity Fair.
When you talk about, as we have been talking about, what's funny, you may remember a line of Woody Allen's about Norman Mailer leaving his ego to, I think, the Smithsonian or something along those lines, which really is a brilliant line,
yeah. I mean,
especially those familiar with Mailer.
Yeah.
Let me, modest gifts indeed. Here's Faye, who writes, the Seinfeld episode about Elaine not understanding a New Yorker cartoon does deserve mention. Elaine is meeting with the New Yorker editor and asks him to explain the cartoon. Turns out he doesn't understand it either. He just likes the kitty cats. Okay. George Booth, I think the dog ate my magnetic insoles.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Where the dog is behind is plastered against the refrigerator.
Let me get to another caller here, and that's you, Mark. Hi.
Hi there. I'm staring at a copy of the Steinberg poster of the New Yorker's View of the United States.
Yes, yes.
And I got that from my uncle Michael Glynn, and he made a living in the 30s, 40s, and 50s as a gag writer. And the urban legend in our family was that he's the one who gave Steinberg the idea.
Definitely not. That's, first of all, it's not a gag. It was a cover, not a cartoon. There were gag writers in the 30s and 40s. So a lot of the cartoons during those eras were supplied by people who supplied jokes. Most of Peter Arno's cartoons, although he created the milieu, were supplied by Jim Garrity, who was the art editor/cartoon editor at the time, who originally started as a gag writer. So there was a sort of division of labor. I talk about this in the book, in the 30s and 40s. Many cartoonists did their own cartoons, but many got ideas. When William Shawn took over from Harold Ross died, I think, in 51, and then in the 60s, the idea became more and more about authenticity. that you wanted to feel. You're a little bit disappointed to find out that Peter Arnold's jokes are not his, right? And not all of Charles Adams was as he got old either. It's a little bit, you know, it's not that great. Or you think it would be greater if it were. But in the 60s, the whole ethos of the 60s is authenticity. You like that it's Bob Dylan, it's his song. He's the one singing it. And so you probably wouldn't want Pavarotti to sing it, even though he has a better voice. And so that's what's really happened with the cartoons, is there are really no gag writers anymore. The cartoon is like a one little stop production, from drawing it to coming up with the idea to everything about it. I think that sort of makes it unique in our comedy environment, where everything is really so slick and there's so many people combining, and the comedy is great, but it's not one person. But in The New Yorker, it is one person.
I still can't get past Pavarotti singing Dylan. But what happens when somebody sends in a cartoon? It's a brilliant joke, it's a funny joke and so forth, but the cartooning itself is just mediocre, or maybe even less than mediocre.
You mean, well, the drawing? Well, drawing is an interesting topic. I talk about it in the book, where there's good drawing. There's bad good drawing, where it's very, very stiff. It's drawing everything right. There's bad drawing. That's horrible. And there's good bad drawing, like Thurber, like singing, like Tom Waits singing, like Dylan singing. And that's actually rarer than someone who can draw well. But for the most part, sending in one cartoon like a stamping amateur on your head.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking about Mankoff, author of How About Never Is Never Good For You. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll bring another caller on here, and that's Marlene. Good morning. Hi.
Good morning. And I tuned in late. I hope they repeat this at 10 o'clock. But I've been a subscriber for 3,000 years, although I don't look my age.
Well, you're antediluvian period.
I like that.
Anyhow, did you mention, I'm at a disadvantage because I didn't hear the other 45
minutes. That's okay,
minutes.
Go right ahead.
Did you mention Phil Toth? Is that his name? Phil, I know Toth is the last name, I'm not sure of the first name.
You
the cartoonist.
Say the name again?
T-O-T-H.
T-O-T-H.
Yeah. Well, he did that incredible cartoon, which it had a pilgrim and an Indian standing in the 16th century village at Thanksgiving, and said, let's keep it simple this year. Let's just have the pilgrims, the Indians, and the Rosenthals.
Oh, yeah, it's Paul Noth.
No, it's not Toth. You're right.
Paul
right.
Noth. Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
He's funny. So I called all the Rosenthals in the San Francisco phone book and told them they should get the magazine.
I sold that cartoon to a lot of them. But that's great. Paul is a new cartoonist, relatively new, and I talk about that in my book, and that one of my mandate in taking over in 97 was to create a new generation of people doing it.
The
torch has been passed. But, hey, give it back! No.
Thank you for the call, Marlene. We get another caller on here from Belvedere. William, welcome.
Yes, thank you very much. The guest alluded to something which I would appreciate him commenting on. He told this joke, which he found very funny, about a disabled person who, with a matchmaker and this disabled,
right.
You're married, and not only was they're blind,
right.
But they limped, they had bad things. Now, there was a time when I was 16 years old or 14 years old, I would have found that absolutely hilarious. But something has changed now. And I'm wondering whether it's just in me, where I found it offensive.
Well, you know, the annals of the offended are very great and long.
But political correctness, as it's been called, promiscuously.
I mean, also, that was a historical, I was telling a historical joke. And, you know, the truth is, in terms of, humor is part of free speech. I was telling a joke. I'm sorry that it offended you. But I think the offense of offending is way overrated.
William, thank you for the call. Let me read some more of your emails. Penelope writes, I have two old favorites from many years ago that may have been in the old Odd Botkins comic, A Huge Flock of Sheep Spanning to the Horizon, and comes to a point where it is led by a single shepherd with a staff and one sheep in the back, says to the other, I don't like it either, but what can one person do? The bearded prophet in a robe carrying a sign, the Nend is ear. Richard says, Gayon Wilson is my favorite cartoonist I've seen in The New Yorker. Do his cartoons get automatically printed, or are his subject to editorial selection like everybody else?
No cartoons by anyone at any time ever in The New Yorker magazine are automatically printed.
Tom writes, father and son sitting on a kid's bed having the talk. Dad says, son, I think it's time for you to choose your sexual orientation. I haven't found it in any New Yorker compilations. Is it from somewhere else?
Maybe. I did I did a cartoon that's sort of similar one time where one woman is talking to the other, showing pictures and saying, you know, we don't push the children when the time is right. We think they'll be able to choose their own gender. So similar.
Lisa writes, many make me laugh out loud and run for the scissors. Recent one I loved, especially with many friends having marital troubles. Don't want a divorce, just want a gap year. Hilarious and so relevant.
That's Barbara Smaller.
A listener asks on Facebook, how is your relationship with your featured cartoonists, i.e. Roz Chast and Roos McCall?
Well, very good. They're my friends.
And we'll get another. And Roz will be on a couple weeks, I think. Irene, hi, you're on.
Hi, I wanted to mention, have a comment and a question. I like the category of cartoons where there's no caption needed, like that famous Charles Adams skiing cartoon.
Right.
Diffy Che Guevara t-shirt.
Right, that, right.
Those are nice. And the question is, I used to have a clipping of a cartoon from The New Yorker. It was a great etching from Through the Looking Glass, a tenniel, and Alice was saying, I'd like to purchase a very small handgun. And I can't, how would I find that?
You'd probably find it, you'd find it on the cartoonbank.com.
But how do I search for it if I don't really know the exact caption?
Well, what I would do is I would search for any word that you're sure of. And then all the cartoons
like
with that word will come up.
Yeah, so if I put handgun in.
Right.
Good luck in finding it. And
yeah.
I want to get one more quick call on from Forestville. Robin, hi.
Hello. I wanted to speak about a couple of my most favorite cartoons, out of many. But there was one years ago called, I believe it was called Blind Date. And this young woman is being set up with a blind date. And it turns out that it's Louis the 14th.
Thank you for that.
I don't know if that's a New Yorker cartoon.
Bob Mankoff, good to have you with us. Thank you so much. Happy birthday.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
And the book, again, is How About Never? Is Never Good for You. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can continue this conversation online, kqed.org. And, in fact, want to remind you, who's behind the scenes here? Forums produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Online support from David Marks, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns, Jack Detch, Marisa Endicott, Maryam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Daniel Radin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.